him.
Okay. Good morning. We'll open the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection. It's Thursday, February the 3rd. Reminder to everyone, please turn your cell phones off. I turned mine off, I think. We're going to start today. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2060. And Mr. Hibner, you're going to, you and your, Mr. Mills,
Mr. Mills. Yes,
thank you. Please come to the, be sure and state your name before your testimony, and thank you for coming this morning.
Well, good morning. Co-Chairs Wisnett and Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chuck Hibner, and I am the administrator for the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery for the Department of Human Services and for our Oregon Health Authority. And with me today is Rick Mills. He's one of our analysts, so he'll be helping us with any technical questions you may have about this bill. Today we're here to seek your support for House Bill 2060, which would authorize the Oregon Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority to use employment data of the Oregon Employment Department to recover overpayments. Our office, the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, does identify, verify, and recover payments to providers and recipients for a number of programs provided by the authority and by the department. Our overpayment writing unit, who takes the who develops the overpayments themselves, they take the information and determine whether or not it was an overpayment and then go about calculating the amount. And our recovery unit, which is a separate unit which does the actual recovery, both are users of employer and wage information when they perform their duties. Currently, our overpayment writing unit, the overpayment writing unit, overpayment writers do have direct access to employment data, whereas our recovery specialists are not authorized. So that's what we're seeking here today. Our recovery specialists would have access to this information from alternative sources, but the data that comes directly from the employment department is the most timely, complete, and accurate source of information, while also being the most least expensive for us to obtain. This legislation is important because the information that we would use is important to us doing our work efficiently, and it also helps us provide optimum customer services to our clients, allows us to use the best and most current information during a time which could be particularly difficult for them. So we want to be able to help them and have the most accurate information we have available to do that. This legislation would also ensure that there is alignment between our business preferences and practices, what other Oregon state agencies have been authorized to do, and what state and federal statutes. Federal law does protect this employment data. It's maintained by the Employment Department, so it is federal information. However, federal law does grant an exception to public officials in the performance of their duties. There's a number of criteria that we must meet for this exception, one being that there's a specific, clear granting of authority to the public official in state law. And if you've happened to review the laws that exist, there are a number of those exceptions which are already in law, which we're seeking almost identical one to what the Oregon Department of Transportation has as Section N of that law. The Oregon Employment Department did help us draft this amendment, And as I stated, Section N of the Oregon Department of Transportation, their authorization was used as a model for what we're asking for today. Thank you for your time and willingness to hear our testimony, and we'd be certainly happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, so thank you, sir. So, Mr. Mills, you're not testifying, you're just here.
Chair Wisnett, no, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, committee, any questions? Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony today. So, this is being brought forth by the Oregon Health Authority, right?
Chair Holvey,
her representing today?
Yeah, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron. This is actually brought by us. It's brought by both. Depends when I look at it. The Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority, because they're both being represented by OPAR in the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. So it's really both entities if they're considered legally.
Okay. So I have a series of questions. I want to make sure I understand this. So this is to collect employment data on somebody who's already been enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan.
It could be a number of it could be any number of the programs.
Can you describe a few of those, please?
Yeah. Yes, we have, our food stamps program, our SNAP program, the temporary assistance to needy families. It would be Oregon Health Plan. It would also include employment-related data or employment-related daycare. Any others?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron.
Acknowledge yourself now, please, Mr.
Oh, I'm sorry. Richard Mills, Department of Human Services. This would be, we have to understand that the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery is going to be what's called a joint service for both Department of Human Services and the Office of Health Authority. And so our overpayment recovery unit will be recovering overpayments for both of those entities. So this will be for multiple programs, as Mr. Hibner indicated. That includes supplemental needs programs, commonly known as food stamps, Medicaid, which would include the Oregon Health Plan, TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, and there may be some others that are escaping my memory at the moment.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Continue. Thank you.
So today, when somebody applies for one of those programs, do you have the authority to check with the Employment Department on their current earnings and their current, and if not, how do you evaluate what those criteria are?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, we currently do have authority to access unemployment data for the purposes of determining eligibility for individuals. In fact, there is federal law that actually requires it for some of the programs that we implement, particularly the food stamps program. But we do not currently in the statutes have authority to use that information to engage in recovering overpayments.
Continue.
So just clear, so I'm clear. So when somebody applies for the food stamp program today, you do go over, right? Did I hear you say that you have the authority and you do go to the Employment Department to check their records?
Chair Colby, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron. Yes, our field workers do have access to that information during the application process in determining eligibility of the individual.
Okay. So this is for when somebody is on the program and during their time on the program they have earned a level of income that becomes suspicious in some way, and you're now going back and I'm just trying to figure out, if we're checking up front, how does this apply?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, what this is about is an overpayment is when somebody has received some benefits to which they're not eligible to receive for whatever reason. It could be because some information was omitted during the application process. It could be because somebody in the department made an error in determining their eligibility. And in worst cases, there are some people who, well, they aren't quite as straightforward as they should be with us, and that could result in an overpayment. So what has happened is, for whatever reason, we've already established that they received some benefits to which they weren't entitled. Then there's a hearing process which they're entitled to have, and after that process is completed, then we have the authority to issue what's known as a distraint warrant, which has the same effect as a judgment from a court in order to collect that debt. And so we use the unemployment data the employment data to determine whether the person, what we would be looking for is new hires. People who we've already determined for whatever reason sometime in the past have an overpayment, the overpayment hasn't been paid, we would do a data match against people who are showing up as new hires, and then we would evaluate whether it'd be appropriate to issue a garnishment.
And if I might, Representative Cameron, and furthermore, this information is used during the eligibility determination process and is often found in the files before it gets to the recovery, where they're working, what they're earning, if they certainly are. And even as it goes as far into the process as someone who's trying to identify and decide if there truly is an overpayment, the amount, they have access to this employment data to verify information that they may need to verify in order to determine that. It's once it goes from that cube to the cube next to it where the recovery specialist is is expected to kind of to help recover that information, that direct access to that employment data is not allowed because of the federal rules, and that's why we're seeking to be added as a specific activity, I guess.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for those questions. Representative Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I believe it was in 2009 session we passed a bill that allowed agencies to share information with each other, so I'm a little bit confused if this bill is really necessary, but correct me if I'm wrong, you have it's a federal issue you're trying to deal with through the Employment Department to get an exemption from the federal restraints in sharing that information.
Exactly, Chair Holvey. The federal rules require for collection purposes that you have a very specific authorization in state law. And I'm sure that's why the law was set up in the first place, and those sorts of exceptions have been added all along. We're to end. We would be O, I think. And I'm in O. Yeah, we'd be O. So, yeah, it is a federal issue.
So the follow-up, Mr. Chair,
please.
So the laws we passed allowing state agencies to share information with each other are too general and aren't specific enough for you to get this authorization from the Employment Department. I think I'd like to hear from the Employment Department as well, if we may, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, Chair Holvey, our understanding is that because of this, it's this specific information that has very specific rules wrapped around it, that they would be best to answer.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant. Yeah, one of the things we have to always bear in mind is much of the data that's collected by various state agencies also has some sort of tie into federal law, and so we oftentimes have to hop through both state hoops, so to speak, and federal hoops in much of what we deal with.
Mrs. Johnson, could you join us at the table, please?
She has testimony.
Please state your name and thank you for joining
us. I'm Susan Johnson. I'm the acting administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division.
Okay. Representative Hovey, do you have...
Yeah, I think you heard my question. You know, we did pass a bill that allows state agencies to share information with each other and for the purposes of enforcing Oregon state law. So I'm trying to understand this nuance is because you need this federal, exemption so you can share specific information, or this is a federal requirement why we're having to do this additionally to what we've already passed.
Right. Co-Chair Holvey and Wisnant. Federal law clearly lines out who has rights to receive, to have access to the unemployment insurance data. And so food stamps for administering the program, child support collection, and so forth. So there are a few, railroad has access. So there are a few agencies that are spelled out by federal law. Those that are not need to go through the state system in order to enact state law to give them access.
I'm thinking about your answer. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think she answered my question, but I'm still thinking about it.
Okay. Any other questions, committee members? Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony, for bringing us this bill today. Let me, before you leave, you're saying that your override riders are authorized access, your recovery specialists are not. Federal law grants an exception in the performance of their duty to do this, but we have to have the bill to do this.
Precisely.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else signed up to testify on this bill?
No.
Okay. So we'll close the... close the public hearing on House Bill 2060. Committee members, have to open it. Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2060. Committee members, I'd like to move this unless you have other, like to look at it further. Any concern about it? I think it is pretty straightforward. Co-Chair Hovey and I looked at it and we thought that it was basically a tech fix, so we didn't have any opposition. So everyone comfortable with moving the bill? Okay, so we're gonna on the passive, we're gonna do voice. Okay, if you'll read the call for vote.
Need a motion first, I think.
Oh, we got a motion. Okay, I guess we have a motion. You have a back.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 2060 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion to move House Bill 2060 to the floor of a due pass recommendations. Any comments? Any further comments, questions?
Yeah, I got a quick. Mr. Chair, are we going to be doing work sessions on the remainder of these bills today?
No, sir.
Great.
Not all the bills. We're going to do the next one, we hope.
That's out of order.
Okay. We'll call the roll, please.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Excused.
Representative
Clumber? Aye. Representative Tapias?
Aye.
Vice
Chair Sheehan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby?
Aye.
Co-Chair Brooks?
Aye. Thank you. Okay, so we'll close the work session. We passed our first bill. Good job. Okay. I need a carrier.
The home now?
Should we ask Representative Conger to carry this bill on the floor, please? Would you so graciously accept?
I would not only graciously accept, I'd be glad to, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. That was really gracious.
Most gracious. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2061. We have Mrs. Nelson Baca and testifying on this. Would you please identify yourself before you begin your testimony, please?
Chair Wisnett, Chair Holby. My name is Wendy Nelson Baca, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Document Management for Shared Services for the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. And with me here today is Anthony Thomas. And he is the Deputy Administrator for the Office of Document Management, and he is here today to assist with any technical questions that may arise.
Thank you.
I'm here today to speak to you in support of House Bill 2061. And what this bill does is it gives governmental agencies the ability to determine whether or not to use electronic transactions in the course of their daily business and business practices. We're always looking for ways to improve our business practices and to streamline our services to clients and providers. And also, paramount to us is to reduce overall costs of processing the documents that we do. An imaging department in the Department of Human Services and Health Authority has been running for about 6 years now, and we've been imaging strategic documents within the department. Some of those might include the Oregon Health Plan from applications from clients, also the food stamp applications. And as a result of that, we've seen a reduction in our overall costs for processing these applications. And we've also seen an expediency in serving clients. And so part of that is just that we process over 2 million per month in pieces of paper that run through this office every month. So you can just imagine how large that looks. And with these imaging services or the electronic process that, of these documents, we have been able to bring those documents in, determine eligibility simply by transferring the electronic document to eligibility workers rather than paper. And as a result of that, it's been a direct result of that process itself that has enabled us to reduce costs. And so with that, we today are here seeking to reconcile the current statute with processes that are recognized in both public and private industry as being used constantly. So we've, like I said, been using that for about 6 years now, and we're just looking to reconcile current statute with our business practices. So
thank you very much for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Committee members, questions? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is the consent for you internally to use electronic recording of documents without the knowledge of somebody externally know you're recording those. Is that what this clarifies?
Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, and Representative Cameron. Yes, it is. Actually, we already do this process as it is. What the bill is going to allow us to do is when it says without consent, what it means is that much like if you were to deposit money in a bank, you fill out a deposit slip, and that bank actually images your documents, and you kind of have knowledge that they're doing that, but you haven't given them express consent to do so. If you ever needed a copy of that, they could provide you with a copy of your signature. It just wouldn't be your exact signature or one with ink, which was destroyed at the time the process occurred. And so with this particular bill, it gives us, we already have authority through existing statute to do this process, but it does encourage us to get consent from everyone that we're doing business with. That's easier when you're doing business with large corporations like Blue Cross or such. But we have about 1.1 million clients that we serve between Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. So it's we have an inability to seek consent from each one of those individuals in order to image those documents.
Just to follow up with me, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
So I'm just concerned that when you read the language, and I'm out in Eastern Oregon without internet service, that you're not going to start conducting business with me as a customer of DHS, as a client of DHS, in an electronic way without. You see what I'm saying here, and then I have no recourse. That I'm looking at the customer side of this thing, the end user.
Chair Wisnett and Chair Holvey, Representative Cameron. No, actually, this is an administrative function, and so what we would do is we would image any documents that their caseworker might send to us so that they wouldn't have to store them in paper format. Mm-hmm. It appears on their screen, and then that client would still conduct business with their caseworker at local branches or at their home like they normally would. Anytime that a document needs to be reproduced, it's just printed off and looks almost identical to the original.
Thank you for the clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sheehan.
I have a question. It's coming from the Department of Human Services, but this is specific to just all of government agencies. Is there a reason for that, or would you need it just individually, or can you just speak to why it's all government agencies?
Representative Bennett, Representative Colby, and Co-Vice Sheenan. Could you repeat your question one more time for me?
Just the fact that it's all government agencies, and it looks like it's specifically Department of Human Services to bring this up. Are there other government agencies that are affected by this and would benefit or be
yes.
hurt by this?
Actually, the current statute applies to all governmental entities. And we have actually just brought this forward because we are one of the pioneers, Department of Human Services and Health Authority, are pioneers in doing this particular work. There are about three others, Department of Revenue being one and Employment being another, that do imaging services to reduce that. But it is something that government has not, at least in this line of government, we haven't engaged in a whole lot. But over the last 6 years, we have found such that it is a cost-cutting measure that has improved for us our bottom-line budget tremendously. And again, we were the ones to bring it forward, but we did contact the other agencies to make sure that they were in support of that, and they were.
Thank you.
Good. Representative Hull, did you have any other thing?
No.
Okay, good. Any other questions, committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, since you're already doing this, I take it that you don't have or you don't expect any significant expenditures to build up your infrastructure for dealing with these documents or storing the electronic images. Does that already exist? I see it says minimal fiscal impact on our statement here, but...
Co-Chair Holvey and Wisnett and Representative Conger, there will be no fiscal on this for us. We have been running for over 6 years and doing this process. It's really merely a technical fix that will allow us to not have to engage and get consent from each one of our clients.
Thank you for that question, Representative Conger. I've already made my first mistake because I should have asked the administrator. The first bill we passed had no fiscal either. So we have to, and all of our bills now before we can pass them, we do have to get a statement to that effect from LFO. So we brought that up now.
Chair Holby, fiscal did say that there was a minimal expenditure impact. So
okay.
They have issued a minimal fiscal.
Okay, thank you. Okay, good. So go ahead.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Wisnett. Now that we're talking about the finances, though, I would think that, you know, it says no revenue impact either, but I would think long term that, you know, this may save time and save money. Have you any thoughts about that?
Yes, Co-Chair Wisnett and Holby, it actually has saved us over the course of 6 years, and I don't have the exact numbers, but because we're an administrative function, we actually save money for field offices, and then those FTE that they save are redeployed to do services elsewhere. And so I can certainly get you some information on that, and I'm going to ask Tony real quickly here to remind me of when we were doing, we actually had one customer come to us and asked us for quality assurance. They had how many employees that were doing the work?
Co-chair, wasn't it? Co-chair.
Identify yourself.
My name is Tony Thomas, and I'm the deputy administrator with the Office of Document Management with the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. We actually had one unit. They had two people doing two administrative assistants that were doing almost 2 weeks worth of work, and we were able to take that 2 weeks worth of work and turn it into about 10 minutes worth of work to distribute for their food stamps for their quality assurance meetings.
Good.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yes, sir.
I appreciate that because, I kept looking at this thing, seeing no revenue impact, and now I understand why there isn't a revenue impact, but the bill actually does make DHS more efficient and able to provide more services because they're not having to devote FTE to this more cumbersome process.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to get that on the record, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the testimony. Good bill, and I hope it will save us trees and jobs. So
thank you
very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair?
What just next?
For afterwards, and it looks like we may move this bill today, but if we had, from whoever's carrying it, if you guys could come even with just a cocktail napkin estimate of either some quantifiable metric of what it's going to save, either time or dough, that would be helpful.
Thank you very much for your testimony. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2061, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2061. And
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2061 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. And Ms. Jan, you want to say that there is on the record that there's a minimum?
Yes, Chair. We received from Legislative Fiscal a fiscal impact that said minimal expenditure impact. It says while this individual measure has a minimal fiscal impact, an agency may incur a net fiscal impact greater than minimal depending on the cumulative impact of all measures enacted into the law that affect the agency.
Thank you very much. Committee members, any further questions?
Mr. Chair, what's that mean? Pretty listening? Sorry.
Okay, any questions? Any other comments from the committee members? Please call the roll.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Sheehan?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby?
Aye.
And Co-Chair Wisdom?
Aye. So, and if you have a volunteer, let's see, Representative Sheehan, you want to carry this one here?
Happy to.
Thank you. Another opportunity. Okay, so we're doing good. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2061. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2062. Good morning.
Good morning.
Wisnett.
Thank you for coming. Would you state your name and provide your testimony,
Mrs. Wisnett? Thank you. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer at the State Procurement Office at the Department of Administrative Services. Today, I'm going to bring testimony to you about the department's housekeeping proposal to help state and local contracting agencies implementing changes to three statutes that were enacted in 2009. These statutes set up standards for state and local agencies related to contracting out for services, and they require state and local government contracting agencies to analyze costs and determine the feasibility of whether to perform services in-house or to contract out when the services are expected to exceed $250,000. Key points I'd like to cover this morning would be that the housekeeping items include mostly things like cooperative procurements. We are clarifying when an agency is responsible for handling a procurement for other agencies. My office often does this, and other local offices do the same. Who is responsible for doing the required cost and feasibility study work? Another piece that we are including is an admonition that agencies are not to fragment their contracts in order to simply avoid doing the study work. We are also clarifying a definition of client services, and this is something that needed to be done to assist in implementing the bill. And the Department of Administrative Services has a definition of client services in an Oregon administrative rule. The potential contractor profit, the bill clarifies that this is to be included in the required estimate of contractors' costs. It isn't always finite or exactly on point because these studies are done before the solicitation, but the agency can use commonly known information, past records of procurement and industry standards in order to estimate that cost. One other piece is the disclosure of these studies and the records. Traditionally, the Public Procurement Code allows agencies to keep their records closed until they are ready to announce intent to award the contract. That way, the agency can review the bids and then make an announcement, and then immediately all the public records are open to everyone who participated. In this case, the bill clarifies that the agency must disclose their analysis and their records to the public employee or public employee collective bargaining units that may be affected by the agency's decision to proceed in contracting out. But it does allow the agency to keep the records from the general public again until that notice of intent to award is done. Emergencies. The original bills did not include clear instructions about how to handle an emergency situation when the contracting agency needs to make urgent action and obtain services to rectify the situation. And finally, there is some discussion around the cause of action. This is a legalistic piece, but what the language that has been added does is permits folks who have an issue with the study to seek administrative relief from the local contracting review board, or in the case of state agencies, that comes actually ultimately before the legislative assembly. I have more detail attached. I also have attached the study plan that lets you know how this interim study group was formed and the tasks that we set upon last year in coming up with these items that we believe, if we can clarify and fix, that it will make it a little easier for all agencies to more accurately and fully implement the requirements of these statutes. And I think with that, I'll pause and ask if there are any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Committee members, questions? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My biggest question is the part about disclosing profit. Why is that relevant? Why would the state be entitled to know what a private company was profiting in terms of the contract? Isn't it just the lowest price or the best service, the more important piece of information? Why do we need to know profit?
Representative Hulvey Wisnett and Representative Sheehan, the profit piece is an interesting question. When the this, if you recall, the original focus here is that the agency is to consider these costs before it contracts, and to get a true comparison of how much it costs to perform a service with in-house staff versus how much it would cost for a contractor to do it, and then to truly compare apples to apples, the belief is that you have to include some element of the contractor's profit in order to have a fair comparison. If you don't include it, then it can skew the results of the study. And so it was believed, I think, by the original proponents of these statutes that you should do something about acknowledging that profit margin. And while you don't know precisely what it is, because you have not received the bids yet, you can, again, estimate it from industry standards or, you know, other pertinent information to get at that figure.
Thank you, Mr. But if you're comparing it against the government agency, because that's what this is doing, right? The government agency versus a private contractor. A government agency doesn't have profit built in, do they?
Chair Holvey, Wisnet, and Representative Sheehan. No, they don't have profit, but they do have overhead. And so the formula that's laid out in the law requires the agency to consider its overhead that's directly related to the services, and then the direct costs of employee salaries, compensation, equipment, tools, that type of thing. And it all pretty well lines up to a private sector listing of salaries and compensation and tools and supplies. I think the difference is probably in that overhead factor, and then comparing that or estimating what would the contractor's overhead and the related profit margin be. And again, if you don't have that profit margin in there, ultimately, I suppose that you could end up with a situation where the calculations would show that the contractor's cost compared to the agency's cost is going to be less. And again, remember, these are estimates that have to be done before the decision to outsource. So it's probably a best guess, a calculated estimate, in order to, again, see what the comparison is.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Paula.
I guess I still don't really understand why all the detail down there. It just seems like it would, if you have a number versus a number of what it costs to get the job done, that seems more reasonable. I do have one question on the limitation of the $250,000. Mm-hmm. How many, like as a percentage or even a real number, how many of those are you seeing at that $250,000 mark? And how did you arrive at the number of $250,000 being the threshold? And what would that look like if it were 500 or a million?
Chair Holvey, Wisnet, and Representative Sheehan, we did not propose the original concepts. So I'm not totally sure that I know the $250,000 figure, why that was selected. The formal solicitation limit set by the legislature is $150,000. And I believe that during conversations about those bills in 2009, there was probably discussion among the various stakeholders around what would be reasonable. And I don't totally understand or know the reason that 250 was selected. But it is, when you think of it, it is a fairly substantial number. And the laws accept a number of agencies, small cities, small community colleges, special districts, small entities, where, and so it, perhaps there was discussion about, you know, 250,000 and these small agencies and not creating such a burden on very small entities that it wouldn't make sense for them to do this.
I may have miscommunicated my question. I'm asking, looking at the whole landscape of contracting, how many do you think fall under that $250,000 threshold versus a 500 or a 1 million? I'm not looking for your justification of why that number exists. I'm asking, what does that look like? Are 90% of government contracts that this would affect in the 250 range, or is it 50%? Can you attach a number?
Sure. Chair Holvey, Wisnet, Representative Sheehan, I would be guessing at this point to say a number. For state agencies, contracts under $250,000 are definitely going to be more dominant than those over. And I'd be glad to perhaps try to get some statistics for you and bring those to your office.
Thank you.
So that you could get more full answer for that question.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any more questions, committee members?
Representative. Just a follow-up on that. If we could have you, Mr. Chair, if we could have her give that information to the committee administrator so it could be shared with the entire committee instead of just one of us.
Thank you, Chair. Be glad to do that.
If that's acceptable.
Please. Thank you. Good suggestion. Any other questions? Representative Conrad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lancaster, appreciate you and your testimony. Have you looked at how much it costs to do the studies? What's the and I would say not just cost in dollars, but costs in, I would break it down three ways, costs in time, delays, and I understand there's an emergency exception, so I'm not looking at that. I'm just curious how long it takes, but cost for the agency and cost for the private contractors.
Certainly. Representative Holby and Representative Conger, my office oversees state procurement, so I can speak really mostly to that. We have consulted with local government as well about the impact on their processes. It seems that, first of all, many state agencies, including my own, are part of collective bargaining agreements where we have been doing studies like this for many years. And I know the Department of Transportation is another agency that has bargaining agreements in place that require that. So for most large state agencies, this is not an additional burden. It's something we're already doing to meet the obligations of those agreements. At the local level, I know there was concern about the additional administrative burden, and it may be that the committee will want to explore that further. We have talked with folks. We have not gathered statistics about that, but in the work group that we had during the interim, there were concerns that it would add burden. And I believe that that was one of the reasons that some of the smaller entities were excused from the requirements of this law.
But you don't have any estimate of what it's costing?
No, sir, I don't.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up one question. I want to make sure I understood you correctly that there are similar agreements, or I'm sorry, similar provisions in collective bargaining agreements with some agencies?
Chair Holvey, Wisnett, and Representative Conger, yes, sir, there are. And, for example, the one that my department participates in, we perform such studies if the services are expected to exceed $30,000. And I believe the Department of Transportation may have a similar arrangement.
Thank you.
The committee is either blessed or doomed. We have a business lawyer, so I'm not
doomed.
Blessed and hoping.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for being here and talking to us about this. This particular bill, when I look at it, I look at it as being sort of a cleanup bill on existing statute already. I don't mind the debate of the underlying issues of this bill, but this bill itself is aimed at sort of, making the existing statutes more effective and more understandable and able to be worked by government agencies better.
Yes, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, that's exactly the purpose of this bill, is to clarify and smooth out some of the technical process pieces so that we can all implement the bill precisely and more accurately.
Thank you.
Any other questions, committee? Mrs. Langster, thank you very much, and thank you for taking the time. I think you've visited with most of the committee members in trying to get this, but we'll look forward to the data on how many contracts percentage. We're looking for percentage-wise of how many below 250 and above. And if you can look, and if you could also maybe comment on Representative Congress, what burden is this putting on agencies to do this, and also the people that are doing it. I mean, if you put too big a burden, you're not going to have competition. And that's what we're looking for. So thank you again for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify this particular bill, though. Is it placing additional burden on local governments?
Chair Hulvey, no. If anything, it should ease the, again, smooth out. We had a number of local government representatives at the table in discussing. This bill came out of a study that began after the original law became operational last January. And there were a number of immediate technical things that popped out, and we gathered, and the study group is listed on the attachment to your to the testimony. We gathered a group of stakeholders to discuss that and to say what needs to be taken care of so that we can smooth out the bumps and administer the law the way the legislature wished.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, and we'll get back to you and look for your information to us. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2062. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2063. Mr. Robin Hapster and Robin.
Robin today, please, sir. So good morning.
Good
morning. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Robin Harpster. I'm the facilities administrator for the Department of Administrative Services. And with me today is Robin Kirkpatrick. He is my statewide real property services manager. And it is my pleasure to present to you today, for your consideration, House Bill 2063 on long-range capital planning. And I'm not sure exactly how the PowerPoint projects. Is it something that you're all able to see behind you or on the screen? Okay, thank you for bearing with me. It's my first presentation with a PowerPoint, and so thank you. Okay, great. As an update to you all, late yesterday evening, a sister agency of ours, Parks and Recreation, brought some technical amendment proposals to our attention that we haven't had the opportunity to explore with them yet. We'd like the opportunity today to begin a dialogue about long-range capital planning to bring you up to speed as to what we're proposing, but we'd like to return to you with an amendment for consideration that would meet the needs of our counterparts. So with that, how do we forward?
Here.
Oh, there it goes. Okay, yep. It's a little slow. So legislative presentation summary, just a highlight of what we'll be chatting with you about today. I'll be talking a little bit about what long-range capital planning is. Yes, okay, thank you. Yeah. I'll talk a little bit about what long-range capital planning is, what the problem is that we're proposing to you all today, that we hope that this bill will resolve, some background information that we have back from 1992 and information we've done thus far, why implementing long-range capital planning is important to us now, and what opportunities we have with this solution, as well as possibilities that we can share. And, of course, there's the dollar sign. There's some financials that we're going to walk you all through today, but with measurable results to show that the fiscal is actually in alignment with a return on investment in a very short period of time. So what is long-range capital planning? Long-range capital planning is actually a statewide projection of the condition of all the facility assets of state agencies on a statewide level. What the plan actually does is it projects deferred maintenance, ongoing maintenance, and forecasts improvements and renovations, and even recommended building replacements 5-plus years out. Currently, the state process does not provide for a statewide long-range plan. We currently forecast on a 2-year level, and we have any absence of real detail beyond that from that point on. Projections identify equipment. The report that we would bring to you would identify equipment, physical plant needs, and it talks through specifically expansion and acquisition of land and buildings in order to achieve agency and organization goals. It also identifies the sources of funding, certificates of participation, general fund, other fund, lottery funds, as well as it provides an opportunity for development and adherence to a plan on a statewide basis, creating accountability and aligning priorities for the state with available funds. So as I've briefed with you all, you've seen some of these pictures, but I'd like to share with you the problem. As you can see, these are three individual agencies who have submitted these deficiencies that they would describe as fire life safety. They'd be priority ones. If you'll notice, the I identified them as apples, pears, and peaches because what I'm trying to articulate here is that while they're all important and they are a deficiency, the neediest deficiencies, if you would have been able to see them all defined as apples, would have been the ones we would have addressed first. And at this point, agencies do this in an individual level. We're proposing to expand the methodology of how we assess our deficiencies on a statewide level. Some deterioration factors that have caused these things to occur. We have some aging state facilities in our portfolio. The average asset is about 40 years old, and some range beyond 100 years. We recognize that there's some competing fund priorities for limited resources, and typically deferred maintenance is one of those things that just is not in the limelight when there are limited funds. We recognize that there's just a lack of consistent reporting to the legislature on what the priorities are, and there's an absence of stable and sufficient funding for repair and maintenance and modernization of our facilities. And lastly, which one I wanted to point out too, is that we have a recognition of functional obsolescence in our facilities. The recognition that the work we do today in some of our facilities may not be as effective in the facility as it is designed and exists today. Some background for you. Back from 1992, the Secretary of State conducted an audit on deferred maintenance and identified $150 million in deferred maintenance at that time. In 2006, they conducted a limited-scale audit on four agencies, and as you can see, from 92 to 2006, it crept from 150 to 600 million. In 2008, the Budget and Management Office did some good work to investigate a budget report that identified $1.14 billion in deferred maintenance over 17 agencies. We did some good work in 2009 with Senate Bill 338 with Go Oregon that identified 547 projects that were deferred maintenance. Then $173 million was spent to work towards lowering deferred maintenance as a whole for the state. In 2010, our estimate at this point is that deferred maintenance for the state is at $1.4 billion of $7 billion into the state asset portfolio. And our proposal is that with House Bill 2063, it will be the long-term solution towards lowering deferred maintenance and overall ongoing maintenance for the state moving ahead. I wanted to note for you two excerpts from the 1992 Secretary of State audit, which are important for the conversation we're having today. The audit noted that deferring maintenance on state facilities would ultimately increase the overall cost of ongoing maintenance due to repeated repairs of aging systems, what we describe in the facilities industry as the Band-Aid fix. Additionally, the audit noted the necessity of a single agency to manage the statewide strategic plan for long-range capital planning and methods of assessing conditions of state agencies as a whole, which is why we're here today. So the next question I pose is, why are we requesting this now? It's been identified since 1992. Why do we continue to bring this here today? Well, as statewide deferred maintenance continues to grow, as you'll see on the chart, and continues to go unaddressed, the actual value of our state asset portfolio will substantially decline. We're projecting by 2040 that the asset portfolio value would in fact decrease by 30% due to deferred maintenance. Next, I'd like to present a sampling of certain funding scenarios we'd be able to model for you with the long-range capital planning program. What would happen if at a low maintenance funding of 0.5% of today's deferred maintenance, we could show that over time our deferred maintenance would continue to grow? If at a moderate level of deferred maintenance funding, you would notice that over time we would have a moderate decrease in our deferred maintenance. And then, obviously, the ideal that we have to show, the various solutions, eliminating deferred maintenance over a 20-year period would require a spending of at least $60 million over the course of time to eliminate it by 20 years. So the opportunity. The governor's executive order, which was signed in December, established and paved the way for us to actually begin to address long-range capital planning at a statewide level. The executive order has directed DAS to work with a consortium of state agencies to develop methodologies and methodologies on how to prioritize assets at a statewide level. Additionally, the executive order has directed DAS to work with volunteer agencies to conduct a limited-scale pilot program for long-range capital planning. House Bill 2063 expands the governor's direction to a statewide level, whereby bringing the agency puzzle pieces together to paint the statewide picture for lawmakers to make informed decisions about the care of all of our facilities. The possibilities. As part of Governor Kitzhaber's expectation for the executive branch performance management, we believe House Bill 2063 creates the ability to meet those goals through consistent assessment, reporting, and measurement. Through statewide reporting and deferred maintenance, we can prioritize all of our deferred maintenance to allow for the most urgent needs to be addressed. In addition, we would create a designated fund source for deferred maintenance and long-range capital planning, whereby state agencies would have accountability for every dollar spent to the legislature. Finally, there are some measurable results that we believe that we will achieve over time, a reduction in deferred maintenance backlog over time, and we actually would want to put a target on ourselves that we would report back to the legislature every biennium on our progress. Long term, we anticipate operating maintenance funding actually at 3-6% annually of a total assessed value based on industry standards. And then the return on investment. While there's a fiscal impact with this particular House bill of $532,000, we believe that it would be covered within a two-year period just by changing the way we do business and managing deferred maintenance better. So I wanted to point out just two quick Mr. highlights out of the
just a
OU.
Minute, just yes. a minute, Ron. Representative Hovey.
Can you go back to that slide?
Just absolutely.
On your return on investment portion of that, the $1 million you speak to there, that does that include the increased value of the asset because of the, I guess, the deferred maintenance that you're taking care of?
Rob, go ahead and introduce yourself.
For the record, my name is Robin Kirkpatrick. I am the program manager for the statewide real property services program within DAS Facilities Division. Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant, the expectation is that as we begin to decrease the deferred maintenance level, that it will not increase the value necessarily. It will diminish the decrease in value. So that is the primary objective at this point.
Well, so that $1 million does reflect that, averting that loss.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, that is correct. The $1 million-plus savings is a savings that is generated by the reduction in operating maintenance that results from eliminating the significant critical facility conditions out there that do require ongoing maintenance at very high levels. As the deferred maintenance is addressed, then the need for high level operating maintenance will diminish, generating savings.
I'll follow up, just because now I thought I heard you right the first time, but maybe I didn't. And maybe I'm just thinking about this too hard. So what you're speaking of really is the $1 million is a reflection of the savings of not having to do more deferred maintenance, the operational cost, but not really of the
physical plant value,
the value of the property itself.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, that is correct.
So you know, if in fact the follow-up, if in fact the deferred maintenance that you're now doing, if you had this money or this program and were able to do more deferred maintenance, it really would increase the value of the asset that the state holds, and that's not reflected in that $1 million.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, that is a correct interpretation.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to make sure, because it seems like there would be a value in performing deferred maintenance as most business people that own property would recognize.
Thank you.
It's not reflected there. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Cameron.
Well, again, maybe wait till after the presentation. I'm sorry.
Thank you. So I wanted to point out just two excerpts from the Secretary of State audit in 2006 and the OUS sightline study. A dollar investment in steward funding is equivalent to $3 to $4 in deferred maintenance investment. And the Oregon Military Department reports deferred roof project. Water damage due to delay added $34,000 in cost to the overall project. So recognizing that there is obviously a fiscal impact to implement the good work that we're proposing here, we believe the cost is minimal in relationship to the long-term benefits that this could achieve. The total cost over two biennia is $532,000, and if you'll see by the chart, in 11-13, that actually is $387,000 for 11-13 biennia, and then 13-15 would be $144,000. There would be some ongoing costs to support this, which would be $120,000 per biennium. But based on our analysis of the potential savings we could achieve over time by reducing ongoing maintenance costs, we project a two-year return on investment for this implementation. I wanted to point out our sister agencies that have been working very closely with us through the long-range capital planning process. These agencies have been working collaboratively with us on an ongoing basis and have supported us in our ongoing efforts to consistently report on the condition of deferred maintenance at a statewide level. And some are in the room today even, so thank you. So finally, I'd like to just thank you for the opportunity to present this proposal to you today. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Nice PowerPoint.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Trying to bring technology to our to our solution here.
Good job. Okay, questions, committee? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to, a couple things. How does DAS come up with market rent that they charge agencies?
Okay.
Let's say one of the buildings in here in Labor and Industries building. How's that?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron. We actually have a model that we determine based on the cost to run the facilities. We actually have a uniform rent model for general type of facilities like labor and industries that determines the cost to run the facility, overhead costs such as labor and resources to determine the rent model. And I'd be happy to share with you our detailed model if you're interested.
Is there, if I may,
follow up, Chair.
Is there any charges for deferred maintenance for the roof on the building in the future or the earthquake proofing or in that rent?
Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, there is not incorporated into our uniform rent. There is a depreciation component that is built into it, and that's simply to recover, obviously, the useful, restore the funding and necessary to replace the facility. But as far as dealing with the deterioration of the facility in that respect, there is no other specific component for that.
Paul, if I may?
Yes, please.
So since they're not paying taxes on the depreciation, has nothing to do with the tax issue here, correct?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, I believe the answer would be no.
So And I, it's just always been a we don't pay any property taxes over here, right? I'm just getting at a point. Well, why can't we build this into? And I appreciate you coming together to say that we're going to do this for all agencies. But why can't we build this into a model? Have a rainy day account for that depreciation funds that you're charging already for lack of property taxes we're paying, and have that in a fund that says we're not going to touch this except for these deferred maintenance things.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, that's an excellent idea. It's a concept that we certainly have given a great deal of thought and discussion to. There are a number of mechanisms through which that kind of a funding source could be developed. In the budget report that was presented as a result of Senate Bill 5505, there was some investigation done as to how some other states are dealing with that very issue. And from what I understand as well in conversation, there is, I believe that there is some effort on the part of legislators to identify and look at alternative approaches to do that potentially this session.
Passing out 2016.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Smith, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I agree with every single member of this committee that spending any dough at all, you know, right now is a tricky proposition. And it seems like there's two arguments that are worth considering, you know, we're considering if we were to do it. One, if it's really just a cost shift, it doesn't actually cost a whole bunch of money. That seems to be sort of the argument here. The other that you guys mentioned when we had a chance to talk in earlier in my office was if it saves money because problems fester and deteriorate, right? So it you know, sort of a stitch in time saves nine. It costs $1,000 today, but it costs $50,000 tomorrow. It doesn't look like we're moving this bill today. If there's any way to get sort of amplified information, because you know, either to, I mean, I don't know what the comfort level is going to be, etc. I don't know how, you know, but the if there's anywhere to get amplified information, either to quantify that or at least tell stories, and potentially to focus our the kind of stuff we're spending, the kind of projects we're doing, not just on the projects that are highest cost, highest priority, and even biggest risk, although those are all important criteria, but also those that if not fixed now will be more expensive later, right? That seems like, you know, at least worth having a conversation about. Spend it, you know. So that's what I asked about that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Sheehan.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You began the presentation with a question, why implementing long-range capital planning is important. And it seems like we're planning for fixing all the problems from not addressing the systemic problem. When you own a condominium or any sort of homeowners association, you deposit money out of an operating account into a reserve account that goes toward preventing problems like the ones that you showed in your slides. Why does the state not do that if they're not doing that right now? And would that be an appropriate thing to put into this bill is to put those reserve and replacement accounts into it? I mean, we require it of condo complexes have to submit their reserve studies every 3 years.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Sheehan, that also is an excellent suggestion. In the bill, as it is currently written, there is a portion of the language that enables us to, with your authorization, to establish a funding mechanism in which revenue derived from various sources could be placed to be able to support that kind of effort. So that's one partial solution that we've looked at that we're attempting to try to look at as a limited means for dealing with the very most critical projects. I think it would be a very advisable action on the part of the state to be able to implement a process such as you're describing. It really is the long-term solution to be able to enable the state to maintain the facilities in the most efficient order.
So you're saying that exists in this bill? This talks about reserve?
This bill creates a funding mechanism. It does not talk about specifically a revenue source that would be used to provide funding for that funding mechanism. It essentially sets up an accounting structure that if there were a reserve fund that was approved and implemented by the legislature, the funds could be put into this funding mechanism so that they could be used as a source for dealing with critical deferred maintenance.
So we would have to tell you to create a reserve account? Is that what you're...
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Sheehan, at this point in time, what we are seeking to do is to learn as much information as we can about what the current condition is of the state assets, what's most critical, and be able to come back to you with a report that says, here's the condition of facilities within the state, and here's what appears to be the most critical. And at that point in time, we would expect to be able to have some cost data to be able to share with you to say this is the size of the most critical concerns and issues and talk with you, have a discussion about how that might be funded.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes, Representative
Cameron. If I'm clear here, you're referring to Section 7 of the bill that deposits $1 for our deferred maintenance account.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, that is correct.
Good job. Good pick.
Just one more
that
question.
That doesn't seem like enough.
Just one more question. And I'm looking at the numbers of the cost up there, but I sat on subcommittee, let's say, public safety years ago and listened to Max Williams talk about all his, actually toured the prisons about deferred maintenance that we had. And he's got somebody in that department that's driving that and testifying and doing all the stuff to make sure, and I don't know how many people are involved in that. Do we envision Department of Corrections going away in their in this his deferred maintenance department moving into DAS? And I see cost savings here if we move assets from one place into a centralized place, but I don't see how you came up with a cost of doing this tell me how we're not saving money here.
Okay. Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, I believe it's two questions. First one, as far as the Department of Corrections is concerned, we anticipate the way the program would work is that agencies are still going to be responsible for managing their assets. They're going to be responsible for reporting on the condition of their assets. Each agency now does it in different ways. Some don't even do it at all. And so there's an expectation that will be established with this program of agencies to learn how to routinely assess their assets and report on those regularly to the legislature, so you have the big picture of what it looks like, and that they would still continue to do those things in-house, but they would come to one source so that you would have DAS reporting to the legislature about what that looks like holistically, as opposed to corrections does a really great job, military does a good job, you have parks and recreation that does a great job, but there are other agencies that may not do as good of a job at looking at those deficiencies in a like manner. And that's the proposal that we have here today. As far as the reduction that we're proposing by putting this in place, it's about over time. As you bring source of information together, as Robin described it best, as a kind of a two-pronged approach, first, let's get the information so we know what we're dealing with, and then figure out how we fund that over time to make informed decisions, looking at various models so you'll know what the decisions today mean for tomorrow. Over time, we anticipate that the actual routine maintenance, the day-to-day maintenance, would drop because as we deal with the aging systems and eliminate deferred maintenance, the repeated repairs, the Band-Aid fixes that we do today would be minimized, whereby reducing overall maintenance for the state.
One more thing.
Just
in the economic times that we're in and trying to push for reform here, and I see the generals here. Were big departments at the table when we formed this? And if I went and asked Max Williams, could he save some money, FTEs, etc., to get this done? Has that conversation taken place with department heads?
Yeah. Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, we actually have letters of support to the governor's office for long-range capital planning because they know the benefits over time.
I understand that. Is there any FTE savings in any departments that have been identified to make this happen?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, they have not given me that level of detail at this point, but I'd be happy to go back to agencies, show them the detail, and get that information.
That would be great to have. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, committee members? We would like to go ahead to Representative Conklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question's for Robin. I actually have two or three questions, but I'll try to make them quick. First is, I understand that in 2009, the legislature passed an economic stimulus bill, if you will, and at least I don't know how the money was spent precisely, but I understand anecdotally a lot of it went to projects that I think you would fall within the category of deferred maintenance as you're describing it. So, two-part question. One, did the numbers that you're projecting right now in terms of the deferred maintenance, the total cost, and the return on investment, did that take into account the money that was spent, presumably, on fixing a lot of deferred maintenance problems? did it, and so did it change our status, if you will? And the second is, were those projects random, or did they fit into some kind of, you know, urgency category?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Conger, to answer your question. I actually lost my train of thought, so forgive me. So I think I can answer your second question first, and if you could repeat your first, I would appreciate
sure.
that. So in terms of the rhyme or reason, it was rhyme and reason in relationship to the agency's definition of what the highest priorities were for their program. So what their priority one was is what came before LFO for consideration by this body. Again, it was not a unified look-see at what the condition was of the state to say, we're going to deal with, and you know, my slide best describes that as all the apples. You won't be able to see that, but all the apples that are the most neediest deficiencies within the state that we could address at that time. That was not consistent across all the state agencies. And then your first question, sorry, I apologize.
I think if I could condense it a little bit, it's do the numbers that you're presenting today, are those post-stimulus spending or pre-stimulus spending?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Conger, they're post-spending.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, may I ask another question?
Please, real quick. Let's get
yes. So, maybe I could ask this for additional information. You said that you were projecting a two-year return on investment. Could you give us more detail or provide the committee with more detail as to how you came up with that number and what factors play into that? And then a question for now, do you have an asset disposal plan? And when you're talking about the return on investment, are you looking at assets that could be disposed in the next couple of years? And are you looking near term on what the effect of just selling it might be versus investing the money? This sort of goes to Co-Chair Holvey's question about increasing asset value.
Sure. Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Conger. Yes, we are actually looking at that within DAS, but we want to propose that at a statewide level of when does it get to a point where it's no longer fiscally responsible to address, to continue to maintain a facility, when is it responsible to replace it? DAS does our things a certain way. Other agencies do it another way. Long-range capital planning is meant to address this over time.
And holistically,
correct.
Thank you very much. Representative Holton, do you have any
follow-up? Just a comment, Mr. Chair, real briefly. I know this committee has at least one other bill, and maybe more, potentially, that we'll look at, you know, some mechanisms for providing funding for deferred maintenance, and certainly I would really like to engage some of the ideas like Representative Cameron's and maybe a couple of us on the committee can kind of think about ideas about how we can put together the pot that could help put money into this fund to look into the future at realizing these savings.
Thank you, Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I concur completely. I think it's a subject that we as elected officials are responsible for looking after the people's buildings and their assets, and so we need to do this. It always gets pushed out and not done, and we talked about that when you visited me and possible some ideas to cover that. So thank you very much for your testimony, and
yes,
we'll hope
you.
We can come up with some solutions to address this. I think it's a very important thing that you're looking at.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. So we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2063. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2074. General Caldwell and Mr. Stuckey, please.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department and the Interim Head of the Office of Emergency Management within our department. I'm here today to seek a fix on the impacts of House Bill 3626 from 2008 session on the Office of Emergency Management. In the aftermath of the December 2007 winter storm, the 2008 legislature passed House Bill 3626. Now it's in the ORS. which created the Oregon Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund and the Oregon Disaster Response Fund, and designated these funds as separate and distinct from the general fund. The intended outcome was to ensure your legislative fiscal office could distinguish between the expenditures associated with mitigation efforts and those associated with disaster response. We have no argument on the intent of the bill. However, there has been unintended consequences which have materially impacted the day-to-day fiscal operations within the Office of Emergency Management. The primary issue is the language in House Bill 3626, which designates the two funds as separate and distinct from the general fund of the Treasury. Due to this clause, OEM can no longer utilize an accounting tool known as linking allotments, which allows agencies to temporarily borrow general fund to pay bills before federal reimbursements are received. In order to continue to pay bills on time, OEM has had to create a clearing account within the state accounting system. Our inability to utilize linking allotment with these new funds and the use of these clearing accounts has resulted in inefficiencies and a tremendous increase in the workload on the fiscal staff. Essentially, all bills with federal funds, which is predominantly what OEM handles, must be handled at least twice. An example: when a federal fund payment is now made, OEM makes the payment from a clearing account, and then once federal funds are received, moves the expenditure to the appropriate account within the new fund. This has led to a serious duplication of effort by the fiscal staff. It also increases the opportunity for error. The second issue related to the title of the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund. The majority of the federal grants within this fund are not associated with disaster mitigation efforts and are more appropriately classified as preparedness funds. FEMA has stated in writing that having preparedness grants within a fund titled Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund creates the impression that the preparedness fund could be used for pre-disaster efforts and could raise questions during the annual monitoring visits by FEMA. Our request made in House Bill 2074 is for both the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund and the Oregon Disaster Response Fund to be placed back within the general fund of the Treasury, not the general fund of the legislature. This will allow us to utilize linking allotments and discontinue the need for clearing accounts and corresponding duplicating efforts. Additionally, we are requesting to change the name of the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund to the Oregon Emergency Preparedness Account in order to accommodate the request made by FEMA. In conclusion, we are confident that this will have no impact on the state general fund as a result of this legislation. We verified with the state treasury and DAS that this will have no impact on the kicker calculation either. Our ability to identify and distinguish between mitigation efforts and preparedness efforts and disaster response efforts will not be impacted in any way with these changes. This concludes my testimony, and I have an army of certified smart people back here that really do this every day, so if you have any real technical questions, I'm going to bring them up and let you ask them.
Thank you, General. Mr. Stuckey, did you have some prepared comments?
No, Chair, wasn't it?
Thank you. Committee members? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General, I've got a thing here that was left by from FEMA. This, have you seen this?
Yes, I have. I have it with me.
And I think what you're doing sounds perfectly reasonable to me. But here in the very last line where it says commingling of grant funds is not allowed, grantees must adhere to the guidance, it looks like this specifically prohibits them from distributing money to us if this goes into the general fund. Do you have a workaround there, or
co-chairs and Representative Sheehan? This will actually solve that issue. I think they've at this point been fairly excusing on this very issue because they know we're trying to fix it. So they haven't really they've made audit comments when their reviews, but they haven't punished us. Let's put it that way.
So we currently have a fund then that's separate and
correct.
It's okay. So am I reading this incorrectly that FEMA wants you to have a separate account?
Correct. They want it segregated. FEMA wants it segregated so they can identify it easier and make sure that there's no mistakes made, and also there's the naming of it constitutes an expectation that these funds will not deal with.
Okay, but we currently have this as a separate account. Is that correct?
We do have what we have now is we have the pre-disaster mitigation fund.
Okay,
which is what they're concerned about is that these funds really can't be used for pre-disaster. So yeah, we're calling it one thing, but the fund's got to be used for something else.
But you're proposing we move it into the general fund, which wouldn't that commingle
the general fund of the Treasury, not the general fund of the legislature. There's that's the separation. It's not the big general fund that we deal with here, that you all deal with. It's the general fund of the Treasury. So
that was, I think, that was a
co-secretary.
That was an issue that I think everyone.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions, committee?
Follow up.
Representative Hovey.
Do we have somebody from Treasury here on this topic? Because Mr. Chair, I think some of the confusion perhaps is the way the bill is drafted. It appears that people are assuming that this is going into the general fund of the state of Oregon and not into not staying within Treasury. And I think Representative Sheehan's questions are kind of pertinent as to why are we moving it out of Treasury? Because that's what we were all assuming was happening here, and you're indicating that that is not happening. So now, I think I think it's pertinent for us not to move forward with this. I don't believe we have a fiscal statement anyway, but we definitely want to get that clarified for sure.
Let me get my
to be certain.
Mr. Co-Chair, let me get my certified smart accountant here that can address that.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Sean McCormick. I'm a budget and policy analyst with the Oregon Military Department. The issue that we have is really one of semantics. We've talked with budget management, Treasury, and LFO on numerous occasions, and we're talking about the Big G General Fund, where personal income tax and corporate tax revenue goes into, and then the little G Treasury account 0401, which is a statewide Treasury account, which has a commingling of multiple fund types, general fund, federal fund, and other funds. And what we're saying by within the general fund is within the general fund Treasury account 0401. So there would be no impact to the state general fund with regards to personal income tax and corporate income tax.
Thank you. Any committee members? I think I'll have to talk to Representative Hovey, but I think we're going to have to hold this anyway. So I think a small amendment to clarify that so we don't get, as General Caldwell said, all the other bureaucrats upset, that might make it a little easier. We had the member of the Supreme Court and the member of the Appeals Court talked to the Judiciary Committee about legislative intent to be sure that they have to rule that it's clear. So I think this is one that our time might be well taken to be sure that we clarify that. We can use your expertise and work with our committee administrator. We'll try to put that amendment to clarify that. I think that the committee thinks that's what
Mr. Chairman, we have no issues with that. I think, again, I don't know why the draft came out with actually excluding in the state treasury. Those three words could imply something that, and we may want to add that back in with an amendment to say so it's absolutely crystal clear that that's what we're talking about, not the big general fund.
Well, thank you. And again, Representative Hovey and I were trying to pull bills that we think we can move and looked easy, and this one looked easier. Before we got in here, we were told everyone's upset or concerned. The treasurer's. I see we have someone from the treasurer's office now, but I think if you'll work with our committee administrator, we'll clarify that, get an amendment quickly so we can pass this on.
Yes, sir.
So, Mr. Chair, just so I'm clear, I'm not an attorney, and we've got several of them here that. What the concern is that we've removed, and I'm just looking at the original language, obviously, that we've removed it from, so the language, we just want to change the name of this account. Isn't that what you're trying to do?
Co-Chair is Representative Cameron, that's correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much for your
Thank
testimony.
You.
We'll try to move that as soon as we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2074. Committee members, thank you for your work. We got through the agenda and passed two bills. Oh, that's exactly maybe the first ones.
Hopefully, they're not the last.
Not the only.
Thank you very much. So, yeah, what we need to do.
You want to adjourn?
Okay, we'll adjourn the committee meeting. Thank you.